as Ted Cruz has been. I think James Inhofe, there's a whole bunch of them. So we're going to talk about that on today's bonus show. Remember that tomorrow, Tuesday, December 14th at 6 p.m. is the final David Pakman Show viewer town hall of the year. I look forward to seeing you there and on today's bonus show, which you can sign up for and get instant access to at joinpakman.com.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT, the inside from way out.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Workers at the Elmwood Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York, won a historic victory after they voted to unionize last week, making them the first to do so among the coffee chain's 9,000 locations in the United States. More stores have already filed to unionize in Boston. We'll speak with a Starbucks barista in Buffalo and go to Memphis to talk with one of 1,400 Kellogg's workers who've now been on strike for over 2 months.
My name is Kevin Bradshaw, Vice President of Memphis 252G here in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm on strike with other workers, 1,400 workers across the United States in Omaha, Lancaster, Battle Creek, and Memphis. And we're fighting against the Kellogg Company for equal pay and equal benefits and also job security. We've been on strike now for almost 2 months, and we're trying to make sure that all future workers and current workers have the same amount of pay and benefits and job security going forward in the future.
This comes as President Biden's condemned Kellogg's plans to permanently replace striking workers. We'll look at the wave of union drives and labor organizing with historian Nelson Lichtenstein, author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. But first, a shocking Yahoo News expose reveals a secretive Customs and Border Protection unit investigated as many as 20 journalists and their contacts by using government databases intended to track terrorists. Those investigated include the Pulitzer Prize-winning Associated Press reporter Martha Mendoza, along with others at the Huffington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. We'll speak with the reporter who broke the story headlined Operation Whistlepig inside the secret CBP unit with no rules that investigates Americans.
It was so acceptable. Everything Rambo did was under orders and, you know, assigned and directed and rewarded by the highest levels of CBP.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from the unprecedented weekend storms across the United States has risen to 90, with dozens still missing. In Kentucky, workers at the Mayfield Consumer Products Candle Factory, who survived the storm, said supervisors threatened to fire them if they left their shifts early Friday, even as forecasters warned of approaching tornadoes and warning sirens could be heard. Some of the workers left the factory ahead of the storm, despite the threat to their livelihoods. At least eight people who remained died as a tornado ripped through the building and largely flattened it. More than 100 workers were trapped. Climate scientists say the rare December tornadoes are likely a result of the climate crisis. This is meteorologist Jeff Masters.
We've got a warmer climate, and that means you can get a tornado any time of year. And so you've got to be prepared. Anywhere you live in the Midwest U.S., Southeast U.S., you can get a tornado in December, January, February. We've been seeing an increasing number of these off-season storms. So tornado season's all season long now, all year long.
Climate scientists are sounding the alarm over newly discovered weaknesses in the ice shelf holding back one of Antarctica's most dangerous glaciers. The Washington Post reports the shelf appears poised to shatter within the next 3 to 5 years. Once the shelf collapses, ice from the Vasthwaite's glacier will flow more easily into the ocean, raising global sea levels. A complete collapse of the glacier could result in several feet of sea level rise, inundating coastal communities home to hundreds of millions of people around the world.
COVID-19 cases continue to surge in the United States, Europe, and South Africa, where the fast-spreading Omicron variant was first detected. On Tuesday, South Africa's largest private health insurer reported Omicron appears to be substantially more contagious than even the Delta variant and reduces the effectiveness of existing vaccines, though people who are fully vaccinated are largely still protected against the severe disease. In Britain, Health Secretary Sajid Javid warned the Omicron coronavirus variant is spreading rapidly across the UK and appears poised to overtake Delta as the dominant variant.
It's spreading at a phenomenal rate. The number of infections is doubling every 2 or 3 days. There's going to be a tidal wave of infection. The second thing that we've learned in the last week is that 2 doses of the vaccine are not enough to protect you, but 3 doses, a booster shot, will be hugely effective in protecting you against symptomatic infection.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Monday announced the world's first known death linked to the Omicron variant. Last week, Johnson reversed his longstanding opposition to public health measures and ordered new restrictions, including mask mandates and proof of vaccination, while urging people to work from home. Here in the United States, the number of confirmed coronavirus infections since the start of the pandemic has topped 50 million. Nearly 800,000 people have died of COVID-19, according to Johns Hopkins University researchers, with nearly 1,300 deaths reported Monday alone. California's ordered a new statewide indoor mask mandate beginning Wednesday after recording a 47% jump in COVID-19 cases since Thanksgiving. Here in New York City, beginning today, children age 5 to 11 will be required to have proof of vaccination to enter certain indoor places, such as restaurants. A proof of vaccination mandate for everyone 12 and up was already in effect. This is New York Mayor Bill de Blasio.
We want to protect everyone. We want to protect our youngest New Yorkers. We know Omicron has had a lot of impact on younger folks. We know that we need a whole family to be safe. And if the youngest kids are safe, that also helps protect our seniors.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to block New York State's vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. Petitioners had tried to claim religious exemptions. Meanwhile, the Air Force says it's discharged 27 service members for refusing to get vaccinated against COVID-19, as required by the Pentagon. The Pentagon said Monday no enlisted soldiers or officers will be punished for the deadly drone attack in Kabul during the final days of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. The August attack killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children. This is Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby.
What we saw here was a breakdown in process, and execution in procedural events, not the result of negligence, not the result of misconduct, not the result of poor leadership.
The Pentagon initially said the strike averted an imminent threat by the Islamic State and made other false claims about the attack before being forced to walk back those claims and offer condolence payments to the victims' families because of press exposés. To see our coverage of the story, go to democracynow.org. In Sudan, police fired tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at crowds of protesters who gathered near the presidential palace Monday to demand the military hand over power to a civilian government to lead a transition to democratic rule. Dozens of protesters have been killed by Sudanese police and soldiers since the military toppled the caretaker Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok in an October 25th coup. Sudan's military rulers reinstated Hamdok in late November amidst popular pressure, but the military is maintaining oversight over his cabinet. In Colombia, an independent investigation backed by the United Nations has found Colombian police were responsible for killing at least 11 people during massive anti-police brutality protests in Bogota in September 2020. The mobilizations were in response to the police killing of Javier Ordóñez, a father of 2 who died after being pinned to the ground by Colombian police. Ordóñez was shocked repeatedly with a stun gun for more than 2 minutes as he begged, "Please, no more." Denmark's former immigration minister has been sentenced to 60 days in prison after she was found guilty of illegally separating underage asylum-seeking couples. Inger Støjberg was accused of violating the European Convention on Human Rights. Judges overseeing her impeachment trial said Støjberg had intentionally neglected her ministerial duties when she ordered the separation of at least 23 asylum-seeking couples in 2016. She's known for promoting anti-immigrant rhetoric and policies in Denmark. Back in the United States, the House Committee investigating the January 6 Capitol insurrections recommended former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows be found in criminal contempt of Congress. Meadows had agreed to cooperate with a subpoena from the committee, but reversed course last week, just ahead of his scheduled deposition. On Monday, the committee revealed Meadows played a larger role than previously known in plans to overturn the results of the 2020 election, as well as a failed effort by White House insiders to push Trump to call off the Capitol riot. The committee's vice chair, Republican Congressmember Liz Cheney, read text messages sent by three Fox News hosts to Meadows as the insurrection played out on live TV on January 6th.
Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote. Please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished, Brian Kilmeade texted. Quote, can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol, Sean Hannity urged. As the violence continued, one of the president's sons texted Mr. Meadows, quote, he's got to condemn this ASAP.
Although the Fox News hosts were pushing Trump to call off the insurrection, when they were on the air, they said they believed the protesters were Antifa. Survivors of the disgraced former USA gymnastics doctor and serial sexual abuser Larry Nassar have reached a $380 million settlement with USA Gymnastics, the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, and their insurers. The settlement comes after a five-year legal battle and will cover claims brought by hundreds of women who were sexually abused by Nassar, including Olympic gold medalists Simone Biles, Ali Raisman, and Michaela Maroney. Rachel Denhollander, the first woman to publicly accuse Dr. Nassar, said on Twitter, their settlement also includes survivors abused by coaches and other officials in the sport. Denhollander tweeted, quote, some survivors are Olympians and elite gymnasts and wielded their platform powerfully. Most of the over 500 represented here are not, but showed up over and over again. We did this together. Don't forget their voices, what they gave, and what it took, she said. In 2018, Dr. Nassar was sentenced to up to 175 years in prison for sexually assaulting and abusing more than 160 women and girl athletes. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange suffered a mini-stroke in a British prison in late October as he fought to avoid extradition to the United States to face espionage charges. That's according to Assange's fiancée, Stella Maris, who said the stroke left Assange with a drooping right eyelid, memory problems, and signs of neurological damage. Maris believes the stress from captivity paired with endless legal challenges has taken a deep toll on Assange's mental and physical well-being. On Friday, a British court ruled in favor of the Biden administration appeal to extradite Assange to face charges in the United States. The ruling has been condemned by journalists around the world as a major blow to press freedom. In Minnesota, the manslaughter trial of former Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter continued Monday with a medical examiner testifying the wound Dante Wright received from Potter's handgun was not survivable. Potter has said she mistakenly shot Wright with her Glock 9mm pistol, believing it was her taser. Minnesota State Investigator Sam McGinnis testified Potter failed to test her taser as required on the day she fatally shot Wright. He also laid out the differences between a Glock pistol and a taser.
The taser is yellow, the firearm is black. The taser has a stocky body to it compared to the Glock handgun. The grip of the taser is shorter and wider than the Glock.
Meanwhile, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin signaled Monday he's preparing to change his not guilty plea to guilty in a federal case charging he willfully violated George Floyd's civil rights. Chauvin was convicted of Floyd's murder and sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison. And today is the 9th anniversary of the Sandy Hook school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. The 2012 massacre claimed the lives of 20 school children and 6 educators. Since Sandy Hook, there have been 350 U.S. school shootings, including 28 this year. But there still has been no major change in federal gun safety policy in the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show with a shocking Yahoo News expose about a secretive Customs and Border Protection unit that investigated as many as 20 journalists and their contacts by using government databases intended to track terrorists. Those investigated by CBP's so-called counter-network division include the Pulitzer Prize-winning Associated Press reporter Martha Mendoza, along with others at the Huffington Post, Wall Street Journal, and New York Times. Members of Congress and their staff may have also been targeted. The explosive revelations are detailed in a 500-page report by the Department of Homeland Security's watchdog unit, the Office of Inspector General. It opened the probe after news reports that a Border Patrol agent named Jeffrey Rambo conducted a leak investigation in 2017 by accessing government travel records of the reporter Ali Watkins, who was with Politico at the time and now works for the New York Times. Rambo also shared the information he gathered with the FBI. In response to the report, the Justice Department declined to pursue criminal charges for misuse of government databases and lying to investigators, citing, quote, the lack of CBP policies and procedures concerning Rambo's duties. On Monday, the AP demanded an explanation. In a letter to DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, AP Executive Editor Julie Pace wrote, quote, this is a flagrant example of a federal agency using its power to examine the contacts of journalists. While the actions detailed in the Inspector General's report occurred under a previous administration, the practices were described as routine, unquote. An AP spokesperson told Democracy Now!, quote, we're deeply concerned about this apparent abuse of power. This appears to be an example of journalists being targeted for simply doing their jobs, which is a violation of the First Amendment, they said. For more, we're joined by Jonna Winter, the investigative correspondent for Yahoo News, whose major new expose is headlined Operation Whistlepig, Inside the Secret CBP Unit with No Rules That Investigates Americans. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jonna. Take us through what took place and why this was called Operation Whistlepig.
First, thanks for having me on. Second, there's a lot of tentacles here, so just bear with me. Operation Whistlepig was a leak investigation started by a Border Patrol agent named Jeffrey Rambo, who was detailed to CBP's counter-network division. And initially, his leak investigation targeted Ali Watkins and Senate staffer James Wolf, but it spread to as many as 20 other journalists. And I'd also like to mention that we have no information that this is not occurring today. The same people are in charge. The same people are regularly, air quotes, kind of vetting journalists who they think might have information they would like to have or who they want to reach out to.
And, Jonna, if you could you talk about why they began targeting Ali Watkins and the Senate Intelligence Committee staffer and how they originally Rambo initially contacted her?
Well, it began, as one definitely would not suspect, with an order from the White House to look at forced labor in the Democratic Republic of Congo, specifically about what companies were using cobalt mined by child labor to produce consumer goods like phones in China. So Rambo gets a tasking to come up with a plan to find these data points to give to the White House, who would then, in theory, hit the companies with sanctions under a Tariff Act of 1930. So Rambo puts together a list of reporters and NGO workers and government officials from other agencies and people from academia who might provide information on these data points about what companies are using forced labor. On that initial list are reporters who specialize in these kind of reporting, like Martha Mendoza from the AP. Rambo also created another list. He was looking for a national security reporter with buzz who could, unbeknownst to the reporter herself, publish articles that were not necessarily accurate, that would overstate the capabilities of U.S. law enforcement to essentially trick these companies into altering their shipping patterns, which would be enough evidence to hit them with sanctions under the Tariff Act of 1930. So that's where Ali Watkins comes in. He saw, Rambo saw her article trending on Twitter and thought, okay, I'll use Ali Watkins. And that's how it happened.
And in terms of Rambo himself, any sense of how high up in the chain of command the knowledge of this surveillance of reporters' activities went?
Yeah, I want to be really clear. I mean, Rambo is obviously the fall guy here. There was a Washington Post story a long time ago that talked about him being this rogue agent. And if only, I mean, now we know based on all of these documents that everything he did on every single step of the way, from his plan targeting journalists to reaching out to journalists, to the vetting of journalists, to looking into their sources, to contacting the FBI, to running a leak investigation in-house, to then contacting the FBI again, all of this was done with the knowledge and under the orders of his boss, Dan White, who was referred for criminal prosecution for multiple things, including making false statements to investigators. And he's now back at his job running his division, and DHS will not talk about this or say anything publicly about what is going on. But this goes all the way up. This is not, these aren't political appointees who were tasked with something at CBP. These were career officials who are still running this secretive unit with no rules and no procedures for how they access these databases. And they target, you know, targeting Americans who are located in the United States who are not suspected of any crime whatsoever.
But let's be clear, Jana, talking about it not being a rogue operation, as you point out in your piece, one of the keepsakes that Rambo has from his time in the Washington area is a large glass globe with cobalt blue oceans and clear land, an award from CBP for his work that came with a cash bonus. The globe is a reminder that before the press coverage, he was lauded for his work at the National Targeting Center, including on the Watkins-Wolf case.
Yeah.
The plaque on the globe reads, Jeffrey Rambo, in honor and recognition of your dedication to the National Targeting Center Counter Network Division of 2017. And at his going away party, his boss even cited his work on the leak investigation, Jana.
Yeah, he was a hero inside CBP until this became public. So he definitely has been thrown under the bus here, whether not saying what he did was great at all. But this was something that, I mean, they also made him the Five Eyes representative for all of DHS. There's one person that does that for their annual or biannual or something meeting. He was a hero internally and was completely blindsided by them throwing him under the bus and saying, you know, oh, we're going to investigate this guy. We have no idea what this is. This is a completely rogue agent who did all of these things, and his life has been severely impacted by this. But I think it's important to, I mean, no offense, but not to focus on Rambo here. I mean, this is much bigger than him. It's going on today. The administration is silent, burying their heads in the sand like we won't notice. And the same people, despite criminal referrals, are back at work doing these same things.
So, Jana, let's go back in response to your Yahoo News report. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has called on DHS's inspector general to turn over its investigation to Congress immediately. Wyden said in a statement Sunday, if multiple government agencies were aware of this conduct and took no action to stop it, there needs to be serious consequences for every official involved, and DHS and the Justice Department must explain what actions they're taking to prevent this unacceptable conduct in the future. Of course, Senator Wyden is chair of the Senate Finance Committee. Can you talk about even the report, this 500-page report that you got a hold of that the senators are saying they can't get?
I mean, first of all, I mean, that's ridiculous. I just think, I mean, personally, just as a regular person, I'm super disappointed with many aspects of this, including the oversight aspect. I think CBP launched an investigation into one of their own. DHS Inspector General did what they do, which is launch an investigation to follow up. And they recommended things for prosecution. I don't know. They did not answer my questions about if they had provided this report to Congress. Yeah, they didn't answer that. I don't want to be too negative on them because they were literally the only agency that got back to me out of everyone under deadline and actually said something that was responsive to something I asked. Not this particular question, but so I don't really know if they were supposed to hand it over to Congress. I imagine they should have done that. But there's so many. I think we're looking at this from the wrong end. I think that this is by design. I think this is not some, oh, of course, all the agencies knew about this and that was a mistake. It's no, this was a division created to avoid, you know, the pesky bureaucracy involved with sharing sensitive information and databases. The person running the team, Rambo's boss, who, again, was referred for criminal prosecution and is back at work running the same team, told investigators during all this that their division pushes the limits. They are the guidelines. There are no other ones. They're the ones making the decisions. They're the ones making the rules. And DOJ was certainly involved because this material was passed on to the FBI. And it was there's no way to say that it wasn't used during the prosecution of James Wolf, the Senate aide. It's just not possible. You can see the travel records. He lied about the travel records. He went to jail for lying about these things. There's a direct connection. DHS oversees this. The White House right now, this is not just a Trump political moment. This is an ongoing division that exists to skirt these rules. And the people who run it said as much to OIG investigators. So this is not, you know, I just think, I don't know. I'm interested to see if Wyden can get any traction, obviously, since we have been ignored in every capacity. And frankly, his office has been ignored in this exact capacity for quite a while. And Penny Thompson...
You mentioned the FBI. Could you talk about their involvement in this? And also, you mentioned the case against Wolf. I don't know if many listeners to our program are aware of that. Could you talk about that case specifically?
Sure. So James Wolf used to be the director of security for the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he went to jail for 2 months for after pleading guilty to charges. I guess in the beginning, here's what happens. So Rambo is looking into contacting these reporters. He's looking at Allie Watkins, who's then a Politico rising star national security reporter. He vets her, meaning he runs all of her travel, looks at her travel, sees that she's traveling with this older gentleman, older by more than 30 years, who he later identifies as this Senate aide. This is James Wolf. So Rambo starts this leak investigation. Before he even arranges to meet Allie Watkins under an alias and all sorts of other weird things, he reaches out to an FBI contact of his who's now at headquarters and says, I've got something I think is in your swim lane. Please call me immediately. So Rambo is working with the FBI very early on this. And what he sees is a reporter who is getting classified information from this man that he thinks she is dating. Allie Watkins continues to say that she did not receive information from that person, and James Wolf was never convicted or even charged with leaking classified information, just to be clear. But the FBI, Jeff Rambo passed along all of Allie's travel records, Facebook posts, all sorts of other data that they had run from her, her connections to the terror watch list, which dragged up Arianna Huffington, who is objectively not a terrorist, I think we all know. And continue to, you know, pull all of these records. And Rambo wanted to hand over all of this information to the FBI the day after he met with Allie Watkins. He said, you know, I believe that she is leaking information. I mean, she's receiving leaked information from him. Let's pass this to the FBI as a leak investigation. His boss, Dan White, again, the same one who's still there now, he said, no, why don't we just take a minute and continue to investigate her in-house? Let's see if she has any sources within the Department of Homeland Security. So they ran a whole other investigation, which is Operation Whistle Pig, named after the whiskey that Rambo drank when he was meeting with Allie Watkins at the bar. There are so many parts of this where, yeah. So over time, Rambo is amped up his investigation, but he finds out that the FBI is actually not pursuing his probe until he gets back to San Diego at the end of his detail to the targeting center. And he gets a call that says, hey, it's the FBI. We have just opened up a new leak investigation unit in-house, and we would love all this information again.
So John, we have 30 seconds.
Okay, so basically, we have no idea how many other reporters have been investigated by the FBI thanks to this unit that has no rules and no procedures and continues to operate today.
Jonna Winter, investigative correspondent for Yahoo News. We will link to your major new expose, Operation Whistlepig, inside the secret CBP unit with no rules that investigates Americans. When we come back, we speak with one of the workers at a Buffalo Starbucks that just won a historic victory after they voted to unionize last week, making them the first to do so among Starbucks' 9,000 stores in the United States. Then to Memphis to speak with one of 1,400 Kellogg's workers who've now been on strike for 2 months. Stay with us. Murderers by John Frusciante. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to look at the historic workers' victory at the Elmwood Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York, where workers successfully voted to unionize last week, making them the first to do so among Starbucks' 9,000 locations in the United States. Workers cheered as the results of their vote were announced. 19 workers voted in favor, 8 against forming the union. A union vote failed at a second Buffalo Starbucks location, and a third election at the Buffalo Airport Starbucks has not yet been confirmed after nearly half the yes votes were challenged. The National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, will now review those votes. The victory in Buffalo came despite Starbucks' union-busting efforts and could trigger similar drives at more of its stores across the country. Already on Monday, workers at two Massachusetts Starbucks in Boston and Brookline filed paperwork with the NLRB petitioning to unionize. For more, we're joined by one of the Starbucks workers you just heard cheering in Buffalo. Jazz Brissack is a barista at the Elmwood Starbucks store there. This is now the first location of Starbucks to unionize. She's with Starbucks Workers United. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Jazz. Why don't you explain the significance of your victory, and also what Starbucks did bringing in management from all over the highest levels to try to pressure workers.
Thanks so much for having me. And I think, like you're saying, it's important. We won our union, thank goodness. And the Genesee store, which was actually packed with people who don't even vote at that store, to try to inflate the voter list. We're very confident that they're going to also be the other of the first unionized Starbucks. But we shouldn't have had to go through all of the union busting that we've gone through in the past 4 months. Starbucks sent in a SWAT team, they called it, of upper managers, over 100 of them, led by the president of Starbucks North America, Rossanne Williams. And these managers came into our stores. They were there in every shift, every day part, pulling people off the floor, working on the floor so that they could prevent us from being able to have honest conversations with our partners. And we went from having, 85% at my store, 100% of voters signed up on union cards at Genesee to, fighting for our lives to even win one of these first Starbucks unions.
And could you talk, Jazz, about some of the conditions that prompted the employees to believe that they needed to unionize?
I mean, honestly, we were unionizing because we wanted a voice in the workplace. We didn't think that, Starbucks was by any means the worst employer. There's things that could always be better. I had a coworker when we started the union campaign. She'd been there 11 years. She was making 16 cents more than a new hire. And certainly like healthcare and mental health and certain things could be better. But we really just want to voice on the job. And we don't believe that any job should not have a union, because we think that everything should have more democracy. And I think the real crisis or tragedy here is we would have won so many more stores already if we had actually had a fair process for these votes. But instead, Starbucks took advantage of every delay tactic possible, most of which were loopholes created by the Trump labor board, to delay us getting to our votes and actually being able to unionize and to give them more time to have anti-union meetings and threaten us with, you know, losing benefits, losing the right to pick up shifts or transfer, and trying to pit us against our fellow partners, against our managers, and blame the union for all of the stress and tension that we were feeling.
And could you talk about the company tactics? Starbucks portrays itself as an enlightened, socially conscious company. Were you surprised by the vehemence with which they marshaled their forces to prevent this union drive?
100%. In the beginning, we actually asked them to sign the Fair Election Principles, which is a set of guidelines that sets a higher standard than U.S. labor law for how companies act during union elections. And, you know, it seems naive that we expected them to sign it. But instead, this company that says that they're a social justice company, they say they're a different kind of company, hired Littler Mendelson, which is the most notorious union busting law firm in the country, and literally ran not even a textbook anti-union campaign, but an almost unprecedented anti-union campaign of bringing in literally the COO, the president of Starbucks North America, and all of their other corporate underlings to try to disrupt Buffalo and turn our stores upside down.
And can you talk about what happened at the other two Starbucks where the workers were attempting to unionize? Results not completely in, is that right, are being challenged on both sides?
So at camp, they were totally disrupted, and there were some ballots that weren't actually counted. So we're still figuring out what all happened there. And then at Genesee, they had stacked the voter list with partners from other stores that were remodeling. Not every worker who worked at that store got a ballot. They selectively picked who they wanted to receive ballots and put on that voter list. One of our partners told Bernie Sanders during the town hall that he hosted that it was like if you had tourists from Texas visit Vermont and then vote in Senator Sanders' Senate election. So I think once those ballots are cleared up, it's going to be a clear victory at the Genesee store.
And finally, your response to hearing that Brookline and a Boston store are already attempting to unionize there and go beyond just Starbucks, your message?
I think our movement is growing. I'm incredibly proud of the Boston partners, the Arizona partners, and the partners in the other stores in Buffalo. I do want to note that there's three more stores that are going to union elections, and Starbucks is terrified that Elmwood will be the first domino. So they're already cracking down much harder. We have a organizing committee leader, Angel, in one of these stores who's being written up and retaliated against for the most minor of things. They're finding ways to target her because they realize that what they were doing earlier wasn't enough to stop us and break us apart. So they're trying to go even harder. So we need even more community pressure on Starbucks to stop union busting and actually come to the bargaining table and work with our union instead of busting it.
Jazz Brissac, I want to thank you for being with us, barista at Starbucks store in Buffalo, New York, which has become the first location in the United States to unionize, the first Starbucks location. She's with Starbucks Workers United. As we turn now to the 1,400 Kellogg's workers who've remained on strike for over 2 months, demanding fair wages and better working conditions. Last week, Kellogg said it would start replacing striking workers workers with permanent hires after a tentative 5-year agreement with the company was rejected by an overwhelming majority of Kellogg's cereal plant workers. The deal would have provided 3% raises. Kellogg's announcement drew backlash from across the country, with many demanding a boycott of Kellogg's products in solidarity with striking workers. On Friday, President Biden tweeted, "I am deeply troubled by reports of Kellogg's plans to permanently replace striking workers. Permanently replacing striking workers is an existential attack on the union and its members' jobs and livelihoods. I strongly support legislation that would ban that practice," President Biden said. Workers at plants in Michigan, Nebraska, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee have been on strike since October. They make all of the company's most popular brands of cereal, including Fruit Loops and Frosted Flakes. For more, we go to Memphis, Tennessee, where we're joined by Kevin Bradshaw, president of Local 252G, a striking Kellogg's worker who's worked for the company for 20 years. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kevin. Can you talk about what's at stake in the strike and the rejection of the contract that was up for vote?
Yeah, what's at stake? Thank you for having me, first of all. What's at stake is that 3% raise that the company is talking about and bragging about, that raise is not for everybody. I mean, we're fighting for equal pay and equal benefits. If we were to agree to anything that the company has, certain employees, newer employees, still wouldn't have the same opportunity as myself to be able to retire with the same pension, the same benefits, the same insurance, in order to provide a livelihood for them families that we all are able to provide. So we're fighting for equal pay and equal benefits, regardless of what the company's putting out there. And trying to replace us is something that they're using as a scare tactic, because we know they can't hire enough people to replace us to do a skilled job. So it's another scare tactic from a greedy company.
And Kevin Bradshaw, could you talk about the conditions at Kellogg? Some employees were working as much as 80 hours a week.
Yeah, we've been working 7 days, 7 days a week, 12, 16 hours a day. And we're asking the company, you know, if you're going to work us the same, do you need to pay us the same? And we're trying to get, you know, some relief on that, far as different things inside our language that allow people to be off, like FMLA and stuff like that, where they're not trying to circumvent FMLA and make you use up all your vacation and saying that you can't be off with your family, you can't take care of a loved one or yourself. So it's a lot of different things on the table that we're trying to fight for as working conditions. And also we're fighting for, you know, to keep jobs in America. We have job security. We have jobs going overseas, offshore to Mexico, because, you know, the company wants to pay more. I mean, pay less for more work. So we're fighting a very greedy company right now.
And this threat of a possible replacement of the strikers, this was a big tactic back in the 90s and early 2000s of employers, but it had subsided somewhat. What about this issue of permanent replacement?
Well, the company has been, you know, we got several different ULP charges against the company, because they have been bargaining in bad faith. They've been calling employees at home, trying to get them to get out the union and come back across the picket line. I mean, they literally said that if you get out the union, you can come back to work. So that's one of the other scare tactics. And then just the announcement of the 1,400 jobs, it's just another kick in the face to scare people, because they know it's a hardship right now with no job, no income for over 2 months, and right around the holidays where you want to spend time and money with your family and your loved ones. So this is a very evil tactic. You know, evil doesn't sleep.
Talk about the significance, Kevin Bradshaw, of the president of the United States condemning Kellogg's, announcing that they might hire replacement workers, essentially scabs.
That is major, because when the POTUS stands up and stands with the working people in America that makes this company millions after millions on $380 million in 9 months, it lets the whole nation know that the working people, the working class, and unions built America. And that's very... The very reason why we, you know, we have a president that's supporting labor, and we just want to continue supporting labor, him and his whole administration. And that's just the right thing to do.
And can you talk about the demographics of the workers at the striking plants, the racial breakdown?
Well, the racial breakdown, we have a plant here. My plant here in Memphis, we are predominantly African-American. Other plants are probably more diverse with, I would say, maybe 30%, some a little bit more. We have Omaha. We have Pennsylvania. We got Battle Creek, Michigan. So it's a lot of diversity amongst the plants. You know, some just have more demographic makeup than others. But Memphis is probably the most predominantly black plant out of all four plants.
And in terms of what you're asking of the public, because obviously Kellogg is a name known across America, it has been for decades in terms of its products. What are you asking in terms of the public?
We ask you not to buy Kellogg's, not to buy Kellogg's cereal. Look for the BCTGM logo on the side of the box. I mean, and we're not making cereal right now. So any cereal you see, it shouldn't have that logo on it. So that, those are scab cereal. And those are replacement workers who can't do a job and don't care about the job that they're doing, trying to supply a food chain to feed our American people. And we take pride in those jobs, but they're union jobs.
Kevin, as we begin to wrap up, the company, Kellogg's, is saying, we've made every effort to reach a fair agreement, including making six offers to the union throughout negotiations, all of which have included wage and benefit increases for every employee. It appears the union created unrealistic expectations for our employees. Can you respond to that and also tell us what Kellogg's makes? Talk about the products that many people have on their breakfast tables and through the day.
Right. First of all, those fixed things that they say they offer, you know, those are just their own opinion, because we're just asking them to be fair. You know, to ask for a company just to pay their people equal pay and equal benefits and insurance is not enough. I mean, it's not a whole lot when you're making records after record-breaking profits every year. So we're just asking the company to be fair. They're saying that they're not realistic because I guess it's unrealistic to treat people fair. Far as the profits and everything that they're making, I mean, and the products, I mean, we make in Memphis, we make Corn Flakes, Frosted Flakes, Apple Jacks, Fruit Loops, Rice Krispies, Cinnamon Rice Krispies, Frosted Rice Krispies, Vanilla Rice Krispies. I mean, we make a plethora of all the cereal brands. We make a lot of different other things as far as snacks are concerned, as far as your potato chips, your Pringles, the list goes on. As far as Pop-Tarts, Eggo Waffles, I mean, and they own so many different other companies. I don't even think we have time to go through the list of companies that they actually own. So Kellogg's is a very profitable company. In 100 years they've been in business, they never operated in the red. So it's a lot.
Well, I want to thank you, Kevin, for joining us. Kevin Bradshaw, president of the local 252G in Memphis, Tennessee, striking Kellogg's worker who's worked for the company for 20 years. We'll continue with this theme. And next up, we'll look at the wave of union drives and labor organizing with labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein, author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor. Stay with us.
Bring me a little water now. Bring me a little water, Sylvie. Every little once in a while. Don't you see me coming? Don't you see me now? Don't you see me coming? Every little once in a while. Bring me a little water, Sylvie. Bring me a little water now. Bring me a little water, Sylvie. Every little once in a while. Bring it in a bucket, Sylvie. Bring it in a bucket now. Bring it in a bucket, Sylvie. Every little once in a while.
Sylvie by Sweet Honey in the Rock. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we look now at how the union victory at the Starbucks in Buffalo, New York, probably won't be the last and comes amidst a wave of union drives and labor justice actions, including strikes around the United States. We're joined by Nelson Lichtenstein, who's a distinguished history professor at University of California, Santa Barbara, where he directs the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy, the author of State of the Union, A Century of American Labor, and also The Retail Revolution, How Walmart Created a Brave New World of Business. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Lichtenstein. We just talked about Kellogg's, and before that, Starbucks, the first of almost 9,000 Starbucks stores that have been unionized in Buffalo, New York. You have talked about the significance of what you call this tiny acorn.
Yes, thank you. The Starbucks thing, what's remarkable here is that the
the enormous amount of effort and money that the management put into stopping this organizing drive, it's really a statement on the part of management on how important unionism is. If they're going to spend all this money and bring their top executives to prevent a handful of workers from unionizing, that's the best endorsement of unionism I've seen in a long time. And of course, what's interesting about that is that they had to bring in some of their top people. One of the dirty little secrets of all of these retailers is that lower level management is unreliable as a union busters. The local managers of, this is true at Walmart, at Target, and at Starbucks, they're unreliable. They know the people, they work with them. And so that's why they bring in these well-paid, managers of all North America, et cetera. So if you have 20 or 30 or 50 Starbucks, and this seems quite possible, every college town has a red hot Starbucks ready to organize, then this will spread much too thin of the top management, and they'll be unable to stop it. Plus, of course, the Starbucks in particular has their clientele is sort of, you know, hip collegiate and Upper West Side of New York, what have you. So I think that there is the possibility of a fire at Starbucks, which could spread through the entire company, and clearly management is afraid of that.
And Professor Lichtenstein, I wanted to ask you, in terms of you've studied the changing nature of the American labor movement, and we hear a lot about deindustrialization, when in fact there are probably more industrial jobs in the world today than there ever have been. The difference is fewer and fewer of them are in the advanced industrial countries. And we're now faced with like Walmart, which you studied, Amazon. These are super stores and super warehouses, no longer the super factories that they used to exist. They're now mostly in China, Mexico, Vietnam, Bangladesh, and other parts of the global South. So how does this affect the ability of workers to organize, that we're basically dealing with the reception and distribution or warehousing of goods made elsewhere?
Yeah, well, lots of manufacturing, of course, has gone abroad. It's now a totally integrated system with the big container ships. We're seeing that now with the problems in the supply chain. But many of these jobs like Amazon, for example, or a large retailer, or Starbucks, these quote retail or distributional jobs are today, they resemble factory work of the past quite a bit. Amazon, these distribution centers have 2,000, 3,000 workers. They're blue collar, industrial kind of jobs. And the same motivations that led to the great labor upsurges of the 19th century, the 30s, and later on, the 60s, they're present at these in all these large retailers and distribution systems. So I would also make the point that while one of the Starbucks, any given Starbucks that shuts down or could be closed by the management, it doesn't affect the rest of the company. But a distribution center that Amazon has, have an impact on a whole area. They're kind of the commanding heights of American capitalism has shifted from the steel mills and the auto plants to the distribution centers and the great retailers.
And in terms of the ability of the workers who are organizing to maintain their unions, to win not only recognition, but then contracts, could you talk about the changing nature of labor law and the ability of workers to organize?
Yeah, well, labor law is rotten, and your spokesperson from Starbucks made that very clear, the ability of top management to flood these stores, to intimidate workers, to hold captive audience meetings. All of this is legal, by the way. All of these, and so this is, and there are no penalties, by the way, when the management is found guilty of illegality or firing a worker. There are no penalties. The worker gets their job back, but the situation is so uncomfortable that they always quit. So the labor law is totally rotten. But even more important than the labor law is the managerial mindset. Now, at various moments, when we have great social movements in this country, whether it's the women's movement or civil rights or other, we've had a section of capital which has made the decision that it's better to accommodate this social movement than not. Whether it's public relations or political or possibly being broken up, that the dangers of resisting this movement are too great. Clearly, this was true with the civil rights movement, where Midwestern manufacturers in the 60s, through the Republican Party in the Midwest, decided that they would support the civil rights laws. What I'm looking to is if enough pressure is put on these companies, if the Democratic Party understands that one of its great problems it's facing is the absence of a trade union movement, which used to be a pillar of the Democratic Party, then you will get a change in managerial attitudes on this. Not everyone, but certainly a company like Starbucks, which is going to face a public relations disaster if it's fighting 50 or 60 Starbucks unionizing drives in all over the country, and they're publicized all the time, then I think that's a possibility that you could see a switch. In the same way that firms today advertise the fact that they're really good on diversity, or they promote women, or they are good on the environment. I mean, why wouldn't that be the case with the trade union movement? Now, I think trade unions have a special power, and from management's point of view, a special danger. And I think that we're now seeing that in part. But the labor law is rotten. It's not about the PRO Act to protect the right to organize. Is not about to be passed in this Senate, given the filibuster. Bernie Sanders has inserted some elements of the PRO Act into the reconciliation bill that's before the Congress. But basically, what has to be done is these tactics have to be advanced outside the existing labor law.
Professor Lichtenstein, I'm looking at a very painful text chain of a man, a worker named Larry Verdon, who was in the Amazon plant in Illinois when the ceiling caved during the tornadoes. And he's writing, "I'm fueling up now. We'll be home after the storm. What do you mean?" he's asked. "Amazon won't let us leave." And then the response, "All it's doing is lightning. So what are you doing? I hope everything is okay. I love you." Larry Verdon left behind 4 children. I believe 6 people perished in the Amazon warehouse, told not to leave. If you can talk about this and also the piece you wrote just recently for the Washington Post about America striking and this W.E.B. Du Bois quote at the beginning of your piece. W.E.B. Du Bois defined the shift from slavery to freedom as a general strike. There are parallels to today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, one of the things that trade unions do is that, you know, they keep their eye on health and safety. One of the functions of a trade union is to, quote, police the laws that already exist, health and safety laws, other laws, and because it's impossible for bureaucrats in Washington to spread out all over the country and to inspect firms. You need people on the floor to do that. And if you're in a union, you're not afraid of being reprimanded or fired or penalized for speaking up. And so there's no doubt that unionized firms have a better health and safety record than those that aren't. And clearly, the manager at that Amazon place was under the gun during the Christmas rush to keep people working. And so you have this tragedy. But it's just another indication, another indication of why we need trade unions. I make one other point. Institutions are really important. Consciousness, a working class consciousness, ebbs and flows. Right now, we're in a period of heightened consciousness. It's a good thing because of the pandemic and because of the money that's been flowing through the economy. And so workers are clearly, you know, in an activist mode. That doesn't necessarily going to last for a generation. A union, like a civil rights law or any other institution law, is a way of capturing that consciousness and making it the law of the land, so that in periods when things are
20 seconds.
When you have a recession, then the workers have this, can rely on this. Du Bois said when slavery was ended that this was a general strike, he called it. He wrote his book in the middle of the 1930s.
5 seconds.
And I think we're having that again today.
Professor Nelson Lichtenstein, I want to thank you for being with us at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We will also link to your books, State of the Union. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Reach the audience.
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. 7 in the morning, step on the floor, walking through the kitchen and you open the door. Ain't much left in the bottle of juice because the seeds that you planted never reproduce. Computer's still running but your mind is cracked because the plans that you made never came to pass. Now you're recognizing the times is hard when you're trying to take a bite at your ATM card. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. G's on life and stabilize at the age of 15 and the drink and drive. Seem to empathize, making babies in the backseat on tranquilizers. Papa never was much a rolling stone. See, he just liked to sit and drink alone. Mama always tried to do the best she could. She would work all day and come home to cook. But we all vain, we all strange, we all stained, we all love to just complain. But nobody wants to seem to get along. See, we got shame, we got pain, we got blame, we all a little bit insane. So that's why I sing this song, you know, because everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Even our worst enemies, Lord, they deserve music, music. And even the quiet ones in our family, they deserve music. And I pray for them.
this song, you know who comes.
Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Everyone deserves music, sweet music. Even our worst enemies, Lord, they deserve music.
Thinking about the time.